This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, last week, Kathleen and I shared some thoughts about new retirement savings program that the president mentioned in his State of the Union address called the MIRA. Our plan this week is to take sort of a different tack on savings and share a case study with you that sort of highlights why having an allocation plan is important, whether it's your personal investments, your pension, your 401k plan.
And in the second half of the program, Jim and Lowell Smith, who's the president of Inspira, are going to address a topic that's of interest to small business owners, the pros and the cons of some of the simplest employer-sponsored retirement plans out there, the SEP and the Simple IRA programs.
Now, Kathleen and I have been tracking a pattern that we've seen with investors that we come in contact with. And, of course, this probably has been expressed in what we've gone through as a country and in the markets here over the last 5 years. We call it the fear and greed pattern. And especially after 2008, most investors, and you probably even remember people calling in on the show or even some of the emails that we got, they were in the fear camp. They were looking for safety. I'm not worried about returns hardly at all. I just want my money to be safe. However, in the last couple of years, I mean, think 2012, the market was up 17%. Last year, it was up 30%. Now we're starting to see the pendulum has swung in the opposite direction. Now, given last year's returns, investors don't seem to be happy unless their investments are growing at 20% a year. It's kind of like going back to the 90s when the markets went up double digits every single year from 1995 until the year 1999. That's not what's going to happen, folks, and probably what happened last year, as we talked about last weekend on the weekend show, was more of an anomaly. So we're now starting to see this shift from fear moreover to greed. It's kind of like, I've been in cash. I haven't made much money. The market's up 30%. I want to go back to making 20% and make up for what I've lost.
Now, there's a problem with this, Jim, and it's this issue of constantly shifting around your investment. So first you're in a fear camp, so you put your money in cash or in really quote-unquote safe assets, and then all of a sudden you see the market start to go crazy, and you think, okay, now is the time to shift into stocks. Now, what happens when you do this is you're constantly switching around your portfolio. You're trading in and out of various different types of investments. And I hate to say it, but for the most part, these moves are generally being made at the exact wrong time. Just as an example, in late 2008 and early 2009, that would have been a great time to go into the market because it had been through a really big correction. However, at that point in time, most people were busy moving their portfolios to cash. So the problem with sort of being swung by this fear and greed pattern that we see is that it really is detrimental to your overall portfolio if you're not making moves that are deliberate and have a purpose.
And I think what a lot of investors seem to miss is that each asset class, I don't care if you're talking about stocks, bonds, commodities, or even cash, go through periods of underperformance compared to other asset classes. I mean, a good example is if you were in bonds from 2009 up until 2012, well, you made money. Not as much as the stock market, but your bond portfolio was going up, it was appreciating, and you were getting interest even though it was declining. Well, you take a look at last year. It was just the opposite. And for the first time in 5 years, people actually lost money in bonds because they were underperforming. Stocks were going up, and they were going up double digits. Now, you take a look at what happened this year. We had almost just the opposite. Since the beginning of the year, the market's been correcting. And as of this Friday, even though the stock market is up, we're still in negative territory, down about 4 or 5% for the year. On the other hand, bonds have been doing fabulously. If you were in a bond fund, you even managed to make some money. So we go through these periods where one asset class is outperforming the other. So there are times when being overweight one of them or the other of these three major asset classes makes sense in terms of seeking return. For example, when stocks were hammered during the crisis in 2009 when the S&P got down to 666. However, at other times, when being overweight in that same sector means you're taking an outside risk for a potentially subpar return when you overweight one sector over the other based on last year's performance. But generally, some allocation among the three sectors provides a balance in a portfolio.
I want to take an example, Jim, for our listeners, because I think it's very common to people that we come in contact with, which is gold. And Jim, I think everyone out there knows that you were investing in gold for a long, long time, starting in the early 2000s or so, you were investing in gold?
2001 was when we started.
Right. So you've been holding gold since that time. And at the time you were holding it during that period, you were holding it as a return vehicle. In other words, you were looking for return from that particular investment. And after 2011, you know, we've seen this big correction happening in the metals market. Now metals have gone back to their traditional function in a portfolio. So you're not investing in gold anymore to look for return right now. Right now, the function of gold in your portfolio is as an inflation hedge. So gold as an investment has swung from being a return vehicle to being an inflation protection vehicle. So I think, you know, now is not the time to have an outsized investment in precious metals. But this is a perfect example of how a specific asset class goes through periods of favor where it's going to outperform and then periods of disfavor where it's going to underperform. So you kind of have to be sensitive to that.
Yeah, and another example, Kathleen, is bonds during the 1980s when interest rates were high. In fact, during the 1980s, quite honestly, folks, I started in this business really almost like a bond broker. I allocated my clients were very heavily invested in bonds. I mean, I can remember getting 13-14% in Ginnie Mae's. I was getting 8-9% in tax-free municipal bonds. Can you imagine getting that today? And remember, we started the 80s with treasury bonds. The 10-year treasury note was at 15.6. I still remember to this day, one of the very first clients when I started my business here in California, I can remember putting her, it was about $100,000. It was a jumbo CD that came due, and we put it in a 10-year treasury note, locking in 15%. Wow. Love to get those kind of returns. Can you imagine getting a double-digit return every single year guaranteed by the government? Well, that was the way things were in the 1980s. And there are a few years in the early 2000s during that market crash. Think about what happened in the market between 2000-2002 in that bear market, or what happened right after the famous Great Recession of 2007-2009 when I placed investors in different kinds of bonds, since I viewed bonds as having a better return opportunity than stocks. But now, given low interest rates, bonds have resumed their more common function in an investor's portfolio. They do two things. They give you predictable income, they give you stability, and make your portfolio less volatile.
You know, Jim, you and I have discussed multiple case studies on this program where we talk about a portfolio that's made up of a blend of these three different main asset classes, commodities, bonds, and stocks. And we blend these three things together to meet very specific investor needs. And we've also talked about how you still need to be flexible, again, because there are periods of time where various of these asset classes are going to dramatically outperform the others. So you need to be flexible, but not reactionary, which is a huge difference. So you can be flexible with the allocations to make sure that you're meeting your goals and still responding to what's happening, but not over responding to what's happening in the markets.
And what we want to do is, the theme of today's show is, don't get swayed by fear or greed. Remember, have a plan. And we're going to cover an example of how fear and then greed tempted a family to move away from their investment plan that had put in place and was actually working.
Well, we met this family, Sam and Melanie Krause, several years ago. They're now in their late 60s. They're retired. Sam is a former military guy, and like a lot of men who leave the military, he picked up a second career after he retired from the military and became a project manager. So he had a full career after his military career, which is pretty common for military guys. Now, his wife was a stay-at-home mom, so her Social Security is not going to be all that high, because she's going to be basically earning off of Sam's earnings history in his post-military career. But, you know, they were smart savers on their military pay and on Sam's post-military pay. Really smart savers, really frugal. And at the time we met up with them, they had about $200,000 in their retirement accounts, but they've managed to sock away about $600,000 in their taxable accounts. So like I mentioned, we met them a couple years ago. They came to us in 2011, and like many of our listeners, they had been in cash since 2008. Just really, again, traumatized, just not really sure what to do, not feeling confident or comfortable in their own ability to make good decisions, kept waiting for that perfect time to get back in the market. So what we did is we sat down with them and we reviewed their situation and looked at their risk tolerance, about their needs for income, about their spending requirements, and decided that based on those factors, they needed about a third of their portfolio to be in bonds to produce some very predictable, solid income to meet some of their core spending needs. And then the rest of their portfolio could mostly be in some form of dividend-paying stocks to provide them with the chance for growth of assets and also the growth of an income stream. And we also kept a little bit in gold, about 5% in precious metals as an inflation hedge in the portfolio at the time. So when we first met with them, that was the allocation we suggested given their very specific situation and income needs and spending needs.
And when they first approached us, we put together this plan. It was balanced because of their age. Almost two-thirds was in dividend-paying stocks, a little bit more conservative because of the retirement accounts and also the taxable accounts where we had some bonds, and we also even had some tax-free. Now, towards the end of the year, you can imagine what was happening, and if you were listening to the weekend program, we talked about what was happening to bond funds, why people should be in sort of a laddered bond portfolio because there was less risk, there was more predictability of income, and also there was greater assurance of getting your principal when those bonds matured. However, bonds were underperforming stocks. I mean, folks, think what happened to the market last year where we were up almost 30%. So comparing bonds to their stock portfolios, which was performing much better, they wanted to shift and get out of their bonds and then go all the way into stocks. What they were doing was reacting to 1 year's return in the markets. In other words, they were chasing performance. And so what happened is, instead of a balanced approach, which is what we try to do with portfolios, because you can't achieve a person's objective, and especially between spouses where the differences of risk tolerance may be a little bit different, you can't do that with one investment. So you do it through diversification. So they wanted to move out of bonds and put almost 100% in stocks with a small portion in precious metals, which were kept there. And as you know, last year wasn't a good year for metals, nor was it a good year for bonds. But then take a look at this year. This year, we have stocks down, metals up, and bonds up. And so that's the reason you have an asset allocation plan that is balanced, for the very same reasons. What happened last year, we're almost seeing a reverse in this year.
Well, Jim, when they came to us at the end of last year and said, okay, we're ready to move and change our allocation plan and move everything into stocks, there were really two big problems that we had with this request on their part. The first one was about risk. You know, after 2008, they really were very moderate risk takers. They really weren't super aggressive investors. Losses made them very nervous. And so from that perspective, going 100% into stocks with a little bit in precious metals, way too aggressive for their risk tolerance profile. So that was the first problem with what they wanted us to do with their portfolio at this point. And the second problem was the purpose of their different types of investments they had. Now, they were in some bonds for a very specific reason. As Jim and I have discussed on this program multiple times, when you have a shortfall in your income needs, and that shortfall is supposed to cover some of your basic cost of living, you need to have a way of producing income to cover that shortfall that's very predictable and very stable. So we reminded them that their bond investment was providing that very stable, very predictable income for them in their household spending needs. And we also reminded them that bonds were there in their portfolio to provide balance and stability to the portfolio. In this environment, you're not in bonds to produce a quote-unquote return. You're in bonds in this environment to either generate income for yourself, even though interest rates are low, it's still a source of income. And you're in those bonds to provide stability and less volatility in your overall portfolio. So we reminded them of those two things.
And as we reminded Sam and Melody with the purpose of their bonds, number one, it was providing stability, predictability, especially dependable income, but also it meant that their portfolio was less volatile. For example, if we take a look at this year, their bonds are going up while some of their stocks have been pulling back. And that's the purpose of having a diversified portfolio with different asset classes that are in there for specific reasons. In this case, providing predictable income when you're in retirement or reducing risk and volatility in the portfolio. So we did review their risk tolerance. It's still modest. When you really got down to it, Melanie was still conservative. And when you asked Sam, especially after seeing what happened with stocks since the beginning of the year, he admitted, well, I guess maybe I'm still a little bit conservative. So they agreed to keep their one-third of their assets in bonds because it was giving them that predictable income, which they needed to make up some shortfalls in their basic living expenses in retirement. They contacted us about a week ago, and given the market downturn, they're grateful the bonds are providing that balance in the portfolio. And that's the thing you need to do. When you look at a plan or you put together a portfolio, I don't care if it's your personal assets, your retirement assets, make them all work together and let them all have a purpose and objective and know what it is. Either providing you with predictable income, providing you with stability, reducing volatility in the portfolio. You can't get that in just one investment. People thought that they had that in bonds. And from 2009, literally over $1 trillion went into bond funds because they thought it was predictable. Last year, they found out that wasn't the case. So this is what you need to do when you put together a portfolio. Just remember, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. Know what each investment that you have or asset class in your portfolio does. What is its purpose? Is it to provide income? Is it to provide a growing stream of income or predictable income or reduce volatility? But given all the things that we've seen in this marketplace, it's why you don't put everything in one basket, as so many investors are wont to do, or chase performance, or allow your emotions to get the best of you, where you go from 1 minute in 2008 and 9 or 10 from that fear syndrome that the world's going to end to last year to greed because everybody is going to get rich.
Well, I know that you and I were really glad that Sam and Melanie called us late last year to review their situation. You know, it's actually pretty healthy to quote unquote kick the tires of your investment plan from time to time because let's face it, things change. At some point, who knows when, but at some point, interest rates are going to go back up and bonds are going to look more attractive as an investment. And maybe if stocks start to really dramatically underperform, some other asset class will move forward as the leader as far as what should be an overweight allocation in someone's portfolio. So we're actually really glad they called to talk to us to revisit their allocation, make sure it still made sense for them given the current market environment, given their current risk tolerance. And so again, it's really healthy to go ahead and review your investment plan from time to time. But if you make a change to the plan, it has to be strategic and it has to be reasonable and it has to have a specific purpose as to why you're making that change to the plan.
And coming up next, more about SEPs and simple IRAs. And folks, if you're a small business and you're thinking about taxes, maybe you just got some information to your CPA and you're looking for a tax break, I have some good news. If you're self-employed, you can still set up a SEP, which can give you a deduction. And especially last year, where the president and Congress increased taxes, and also the year before, if you're in California, California increased taxes. Some good news here. So we're going to talk about the Simplified Employee Pension, and SIMPLE stands for Savings Incentive Match Plan for Employees. These are the basic retirement plans often offered by small business owners, and I will discuss this with Lowell Smith, president of Inspira, with you and fill you in on the details coming up next. Joining me on the program is Lowell Smith. He's president and chief operating officer of Inspira. He has over 30 years of experience in retirement and financial service industry. You know, Lowell, this is that time of the year when Americans get focused on their taxes. We have to file them by April 15th. We also get focused on pensions. One of the ways that people reduce their taxes, especially self-employed, are things like SEP IRAs, or SEP plans. So to begin with, since these are two of the most popular plans next to 401ks, let's take a simple IRA and a SEP plan. Explain the difference between the two for our listeners.
Sure. Both a SEP and a simple, the funding vehicle is an IRA, so you would establish a plan at the employer level, and then employees would get money funded into an IRA account that they've established, but the monies are coming directly from the employer. There is a significant difference, though, between a SEP IRA and a simple IRA. The SEP IRA, essentially, you're funding a traditional IRA. And what I mean by a traditional IRA, this is an IRA that is the same type of vehicle that you could set up on your own and put, you know, $5,000 in a year or $6,000. You get an additional limit because it's coming from an employer plan, and it can go up to a significant amount of money, and we'll go into that separately. A simple IRA is where you defer, almost like a 401k plan, you would defer a portion of your income into that IRA, and your employer would then match that amount. The other difference is, in a traditional IRA, or that SEP IRA that's gone into a traditional IRA, I can roll that into other retirement plans. I can roll it into other IRAs. But once it's in a simple IRA, it's actually got to stay in the simple IRA because it's a different type of a vehicle. So there's a little bit of difference in those types of IRAs. They're not really rollable back and forth between each other or into a retirement plan or another IRA from a simple. Now, were you interested in what are the different contribution differences?
Yeah, that would be very important because aren't there major differences between those two when it comes to contributions?
Correct. To specify, a SEP plan, it doesn't matter how many employees you have, you could have one. Really, the practicality is it only really works for a single employer, a person who has only one employee and is themselves, or maybe their spouse. A solo K can only be available when you have fewer than 100 employees that make at least $5,000 a year. So not everybody can have a solo K. With a SEP plan, essentially the contribution limit is for that employer, you can contribute into someone's account up to 25% of their income with a limit of in 2013, and it's not too late to do a SEP for 2013, you could do $51,000. Now, that is assuming you made enough money so that you could do all $51,000. In a simple IRA, the limitation is an individual can put away $12,000 a year, and the employer, through a matching contribution, obviously would match that amount. It would be something less than, obviously, the $51,000 a year. Also, if you were deferring it yourself and you put money in, you would also be able to, if you were over 50, contribute another $2,500 into a simple IRA. So essentially, if you're over 50, your contributions could be as much as $14,500 plus the match, which would be essentially whatever you're making times up to 3%. And whereas the contributions that go into a SEP IRA are really based on what that earnings are that year and how much, what percentage of those you want to put into the SEP account.
So basically, the SEP plan allows for a higher contribution, as you mentioned, 25% of salary and $51,000. All plans require documentation, and documentation has to be updated. There are rules, things that you have to comply with. Let's talk about some of the problems you run into SEP plans. For example, you haven't updated your SEP plan document for the current law. How do you fix that?
Well, mostly you would go back to your provider. Usually, there are two methods in order to adopt a SEP. You can do a 5305, which is a form that you can get from the IRS that you would just fill out and update your SEP. A lot of, though, providers of the investments that you might be investing in or the IRAs that you're investing in will have their own SEP document, which you could also use to update. Now, usually just prototypes where you fill in the name of your company, the tax ID, and you elect if you want to exclude anybody from eligibility. There are some people you can exclude from eligibility in a SEP and a simple. Actually, the rules are fairly similar. So you would update that document. In addition to that document, and on the simple side, it's the same thing. The simple side's a little bit more complicated in the sense that, yes, you have the 5305-simple that people can fill in, but there is also prototypes available by providers. A lot of the providers, though, if they have a prototype, will restrict you to initially making contributions into IRAs established under their brand, essentially under their custody. So in some plans, if you don't have that, if you had a simple, people could actually open up IRAs anywhere they wanted to, but the employer would then have to try to figure out how to get money to all those other IRAs. Most people, in a practicality sense, open up a document with a provider of the assets and have at least the initial contributions all going to that provider. And it makes it a lot easier from an initial data transmission and money transmission process. But then again, if a person doesn't want that, they can always transfer that to another IRA with a different provider. But a lot of times, that's part of that document process. The updates that come out periodically, there hasn't been a major update, frankly, in a SEP or simple document that required you to go out and re-sign up in the last 10 years. But there have been some law changes that did affect them. So what you're supposed to be using is when you sign up new account holders, you're supposed to use the new documents. And those are the new individual account holders, but they haven't really affected to any great degree the existing SEPs and existing simple plan documents. So again, there's a plan document, then there's an individual account holder IRA document that needs to be completed.
Well, I mean, the whole idea behind these, as they're described, SEP, Simple Employee Pension Plan, Simple IRA, they were put into place to make it easier or to encourage people or employers to do this without all the complications you get into, for example, a defined benefit pension plan, 401k plans, things like profit sharing, defined contribution plans, and all the variations of those plans, deferred comp. So has that pretty much been in place? As you mentioned, they haven't made too many changes, because I know in some of the other plans, whether it's 401ks or defined benefit, they're always making changes.
They do. They make a lot more changes in those areas. The changes that have come up in the SEP and the Simple have actually been on the IRA side, on the actual individual IRA. And a lot of those were waivers of distribution penalties based on some laws. They haven't really changed the plan design in years. I don't know the last time I can even remember that happening. 401k plans, the last thing they had was the Pension Protection Act. And in that case, all the documents, as a matter of fact, they're starting all the amendment processes for what we call qualified plans. Those are your 401ks, your defined benefit plans. They're now having to amend all their documents. And that's an expensive process. In that case, if you would amend a document, it could cost you, you know, hundreds to thousands of dollars as an employer to amend that document. Whereas amending a simple and a solo K is just filling out a new prototype. And usually, again, if you go through a provider or even use the government form, there's no cost at all.
So what are some of the other complications that can arise from these plans? I mean, you have employees, you have employer contributions, depending on the plan. You have employees that are eligible, those are not. Can you get into some of the details on that?
Sure. When you go to a SEP IRA, you can exclude, it's a little different exclusion on the simple, but I'll go over that also. You can exclude individuals who are under 21 and who have not earned at least $550 annually for that employer in 3 out of the last 5 years. So if you wanted to exclude people who haven't worked there at least 3 out of the last 5 years, you can. And you can also usually exclude non-resident aliens from those plans, people who are in the United States who can work here, but they're not residents of the United States. So those are people you can exclude. Very similar exclusions in the simple world, although they use a $5,000 rule in a simple world. You don't have to include people who have made under $5,000 for participation in that plan. So those are things that can get you in trouble. For example, let's say you don't follow that rule. You know, if you're ever audited, you might have that problem. Again, the problem is not that much in SEPs, because if you think about it, the people who do SEPs are usually trying to do a SEP to maximize the amount they're putting away. And if they're doing a SEP and they have employees, they have to give the employees the exact same percentage contribution unless they do a special document, which they can do, a specialized document, but they may have age weighting on it or something like that. But even with that, it doesn't really reduce that much how much they would have to contribute to other individuals. But so if they wanted to do their $51,000 last year, they would have to put away 25% of their salary. They'd have to give all their other employees 25% of their salary. So it gets expensive if you have multiple employees. And actually, when a lot of companies start out with a SEP, and once they get employees, they switch because they just don't want to make that contribution for everybody who's working for them, because it does get fairly expensive. The simples are something they then go to where there's like a match and also the ability for that employee to contribute to the plan. Again, in the simple, you also, if you're over 50, you can make an additional contribution of $2,500 a year. Similar to in a 401k plan, it's actually $5,500. It's a little higher limits in qualified plans. With another type of a small business plan, you could actually put away even more than the $51,000 a year in a qualified plan. But there are administrative costs. With a SEP and a simple, there are very limited administrative costs. Sometimes there's no cost to the employer. In some cases, it may be a couple $100 a year for someone to keep the records, but it's not an expensive expense. Whereas if you went to a, for these small employers, and you went to like a 401k plan, for example, or you went to a defined benefit plan, which would even be more expensive, you know, the administrative fees can go as high as, you know, they could start at $1,500 as a base and $30 to $60 an employee as a cost. And that's usually a cost you could push off to the employees, but most employers pay that themselves.
Well, something that I think is very important for our listeners to understand is the 2013 tax year is over, but you can put into place these plans prior to filing your taxes. I wonder if you can address that, number one. And number two, given the tax increases that were put into place last year affecting single individuals and married couples that could push them into the higher Obama tax rates versus the Bush tax rates, if you're on the borderline of going into those higher Bush tax rates, seems like the SEP plan and the contribution could really help an individual out and keep them in that lower tax bracket.
Oh, absolutely. I think as you're going there, and a lot of people establish, now a simple plan you have to establish by October 1st of the prior year. So you can't now go back and establish a simple IRA plan for 2013. It's too late. Nor could you do a qualified plan, 401k or DB. But you could do a SEP. So SEP has the same date of April 15th or the filing date in order to establish one and fund one as any IRA would have. So you can always push that back to the previous year. But that is a good method, obviously, with the additional taxes that you're seeing on, especially on high income individuals. That is a good way to defer some of that money and lower their taxes, particularly in this day and age. As you go into that, one other thing that I haven't mentioned is that, and a lot of your listeners probably have Roth IRAs or would like to have a Roth IRA, have a Roth 401k. Any SEPs in simple IRAs, you cannot have a Roth provision. So all the money is always tax deferred, you know, pre-tax in these things, and then the growth is tax deferred.
So right now, for our listeners, if they're kind of scrambling, and you know, a lot of people here, Lowell, in 2012 were kind of shocked by the increase in taxes put into place and made retroactive by the state of California. Last year, Obama in Congress changed the tax rate. So maybe a lot of people just weren't aware of it, and they're maybe seeing their accountant now and getting a shock. If they're self-employed, basically what you're saying here, it's still not too late to put in a SEP plan.
Correct. It's not too late to put in a SEP plan. Now, you can't have another type of plan. But if you don't have any plan at all, it's not too late to put in a SEP plan for 2013.
Not a bad idea when you take a look at somebody that could be pushed into those higher Bush tax rates over 40%. And here in California, where you can get up into the 11, 12, and 13% bracket, when you think about it, Lowell, the government is basically funding half your plan through tax savings.
Correct. And if you look at it, a lot of these people are self-employed, and they are also paying their share of the Social Security and Medicare taxes, too. So there's a lot of taxes that are already hitting those individuals. If they can reduce that tax burden, obviously that's better for them. Plus, it helps them save for retirement. So it's a double win for them.
So when we talk about, once again, these plans, they haven't changed that much. They were put into place to encourage employers or self-employed individuals to save for their retirement. The government wanted to make them simple versus all the complicated plans and administrative costs that go into things like 401ks, defined benefits that we talked about. So when you are advising, let's say, a self-employed individual, what are the parameters that you use to decide, well, maybe you're better off with the simple IRA or you're better off with the SEP plan? Or do you advise that there are other plans that may be even more appropriate?
Well, in our firm, we don't actually do the advice, but we work with advisors and we help them. I think the difference, obviously, is if you've got a SEP, again, unless it's a company like a professional corporation or something like that, you only want to have one employee because, again, there's that amount that you're going to have to contribute. If you don't care about that, it's not a bad plan because everybody can max out their contribution for the year and get that put away. If you have employees, but you also, maybe you're small, you're looking to start something up, maybe grow, maybe you want to go at some point to get into a qualified plan. A simple IRA works well because it looks a lot like a 401k plan, but it doesn't cost you very much. Not only is it just the cost, when I have a qualified plan, as they call it, which is like a 401k and a defined benefit plan, there's a lot of things I have to do that I do not have to do in the IRA-funded plans. Number one is there are fiduciary standards I have to follow. I have to have investment policy statements. I have to limit investments that are made available to the individuals. I've got to monitor the plan. I've got to make sure that I'm following all the Department of Labor steps. I got to issue summary plan descriptions to every employee. I got to update that whenever I made changes to the plan. I've got to essentially have quarterly trustee meetings to go over the plan and the investments that are in there and make changes if I want to. None of those things do you have to do in a SEP or a simple, at least not at this time. So it's not just the initial cost. It's do you have the ability as a company to take on the additional burden that's involved in doing what would be a qualified plan. Again, in a simple IRA, the only real burden is that you're going to send money to an IRA account for that individual to invest. In a SEP, it's the same thing. So it's not a whole lot of administrative burden. There is one thing you do have to do in a simple IRA that you don't have to do in the SEP. Actually, you can change. I hadn't mentioned this earlier. An employer can change their contributions each year, because the rule for a simple says you either have to match 3% or you could do a non-elective contribution of 2% to everybody, whether they contribute or not. Or in 2 out of 5 years, I can lower my contribution amount from that 2% non-elective or 3% match to 1%. So because of those rules, most people don't change it. If they do the 3%, they usually stick with it. But because they can do that change, starting in November every year, they have to give notice to employees of what they're going to contribute next year. That's the only thing administratively you have to do with a simple. Again, so there's a lot less administrative work in there. And, you know, the investments that are available for those plans are pretty much the same types of investments that are available with qualified plans. There are some differences.
And when you look at this, is there any pitfalls or drawbacks to either of these plans?
Well, I think there are a couple of drawbacks, too. Is if you want to use this as a way to encourage your employees to stay with your company for a period of time, you can't put in what are called vesting schedules, which say for the amount that I am contributing for you, in a SEP would be all your money. In a simple IRA, it would be the amount that you match. I could make you, in order to get all that money when you leave employment, you have to stay a certain number of years. They call that vesting. You can't do that in these types of plans. So that is one other downfall. The other downfall, if you're trying to look out for your employees, and this happens a lot in the ones that we administer, is that you'll make a contribution into somebody's account and they'll withdraw it the next day. Because in a retirement plan, a qualified plan, you have to have a termination event to get to your money or take a loan or a hardship withdrawal. Those aren't available in these types of plans, because so you can't have loans, you can't have hardships. But you don't need them because the people can just take the money right out of their IRA account. Now, they'd probably pay a penalty if they're under 59.5. The penalty in a simple is if you take money within 2 years of establishment, that penalty can be as much as 25% of the distribution. But again, some of the downfalls is individuals can actually get to those. The other downfall is because these are individual IRAs that are being established, in some instances, depending on how much money would go into these accounts, the cost of the investment may be higher than you get in a qualified plan. And what I mean by that is, if I have a couple million, $3-4 million in a 401k plan for my employees, I may be able to have access to share classes of funds or investments at a lower cost than someone who might go in and buy a retail share class that might have a load or something of that nature. The other difference is a lot of common and collective trust funds are used in large retirement plans, 401k plans, and they're not even that large. They could be a million or two in the plan. Those collective trusts usually have lower expense ratios. The idea is they look like a mutual fund, but they're kind of managed outside of the mutual fund arena and aren't 12B1 fees, which are essentially commissions paid to a distributor. distribution channel. There's not a lot of those other fees. So the cost of the investment's less. So the theory is that the investment would perform better. Those are not available in SEPs or simple IRAs.
You know, one of the things that surprised a lot of people, and this was mentioned last year in a speech that the president gave, where he suggested that there would be a complete limitation on an individual's retirement plan of $3 million collectively, all retirement plans, whether it was Roth, IRAs, SEPs, whatever it is. Do you see that eventually coming into place? And if it is, it seems like that would rule out putting in the higher plans that allow for larger contributions, and especially over a period of time where they can accumulate and become quite significant.
Yeah, you know, we've looked at that. You know, obviously, the retirement industry has been fighting against that, obviously, for a number of reasons. It has some legs. It hasn't really gone very far in Congress right now, but you never know. It depends on what administration's in at the time as to how far that would go. If that were to occur, then yeah, you would probably have plans that once they got to a certain amount, the owner would stop contributing to the plan and probably start contributing to essentially taxable investment options. And you also get to a point, if you think about it, from the tax rates that you have now, those people who are fairly well off, who are making contributions into plans, SEPs, simples, IRAs, 401ks, whatever those may be, since the distributions from those, other than a Roth, are taxed at normal income tax rates, you may be better off in some instances to not contribute to your retirement plan and to go into investments that would be taxed at capital gains rates, which are significantly less than the top rate of income tax.
So given this, and this does, since they approach the subject, the only reason I'm bringing this up, Lowell, is I have seen over the years, and of course, you being in the business, you've seen this, how they have changed the contribution rules, the limitations, the taxation of overfunding for things like defined benefit pension plans. Boy, they play around with those things more than I ever see. Could there be unintended consequences? Like when they started doing that to defined benefit pension plans, you saw them being used less, especially by the major corporations, where, you know, I can think back 30, 40, 50 years ago, they were very common. So an individual could go work for General Motors or some company, come out and figure that they were going to get a pension, much like government workers do. But when you change the laws constantly, change the rules, make it more difficult to file, in some sense, there are unintended consequences. You discourage it.
They've been fiddling with those type of rules for so long that it has discouraged defined benefit plans, particularly, are almost non-existent in corporate America, where they tend to be used because they still can work, because they're so expensive to administer is one of the reasons. Also, some of the contribution rules is often used in smaller companies as more of estate planning tools, because you could actually have a 401k and a defined benefit plan, and those people are willing to kind of fiddle with it because all the money in there is going to be for a small group of usually highly comped or owners that use defined benefit plans. But the other thing they've added a lot of complication. Now there's fee disclosure on retirement plans and defined contribution plans where, you know, everywhere you have to tell all the employees what they paid. All the providers have to tell specifically to the employers what they're paying for, which is not a bad idea. It's just adding more costs. So what they're doing is they're trying to protect a lot of times the account holder, but they're adding so much cost to it that the employers are just saying, oh, this is just too much trouble. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'll go to something that's a little easier. Problem is, the only thing that's really any easier right now is the SEPs and the simples.
Yeah, because I've seen this, because we deal with a lot of private owners of their own business. And I have seen over the years where some of them just said, you know what, this is just getting too complicated. I've even seen some of them just say, you know what, it's not worth the hassle. By the time I have to contribute to all my employees, by the time I pay the administration costs, by the time I pay for the compliance costs, do everything that I'm required to do, I'm almost paying as much for administration and everything else as I'm getting a benefit for myself. So I've seen one employer that basically says, look, I'm going to give you a bonus at the end of the year. You do with it whatever you want. Set up your own IRA. But they basically cut out their pension plan because of all the administrative costs and all the hassles of dealing with these plans.
And I think you're seeing a lot of that. Obviously, it's unintended consequence because they obviously would like people to have plans for individuals. But if they keep making it more and more complicated to do business and do these plans, you're going to have fewer employees putting meaningful programs into place. But again, they always have a place to go as long as they're small. They can do the simple IRAs if they're under 100. Not too many of those companies that are going to do SEPs unless they're just individual employees of that company, sole proprietors.
Well, listen, Lowell, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the services you provide, how could they do so, please?
You can always go to www.inspirafs.com and learn about the services we provide. Essentially, we provide these services to others. We don't actually sell directly any services. What we're doing is we work for other companies. We private label, we white label IRA solutions for others, advisors, banks, record keepers of 401k plans. That's kind of our core business.
Well, listen, Lowell, thanks for joining us on the program.
Well, thank you very much, Jim.
That concludes my interview with Lowell Smith. Once again, if you're self-employed and you're thinking about what you can do to save on taxes, and especially if you're in that situation because of the tax increases that were put into place at the federal level last year in 2013 or in California in 2012, if you're on the borderline between the Obama tax rates or the Bush tax rates, you know, think of this SEP plan and maybe the last thing that you can do, you can still have the opportunity to put one in place. So please talk to your financial planner, your financial advisor on that, because this might be one of those tax breaks that could help out. And look at it this way. If you're in a high tax bracket, you may have the governor and the president contributing half of what it costs to put that plan into effect through tax savings. Anyway, that concludes today's show. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. We hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.